the platform. Step up and speak out.
You're indeed tuned into ZFM Stereo, my station, your station, the hottest radio in town. The name is Larry Quiteri, and yes, it is a Tuesday, the 5th of February, 2019. It's 29 minutes before the hour of 8 o'clock. I'm with you until 9 p.m. So in the first hour, we'll be having the platform, and the last 30 minutes, we'll be having health matters. And today, we're on health matters, we'll be discussing World Cancer Day. So I'll be having a guest at that point. But in the first hour, before I do that, let me remind you of the frequencies you can listen to us on. Chivu 99.8, Kariba 105.3, Motorashanga 97.6, Bulawa in my hometown 106.7, and a broadcasting out of Harare where our frequency is 106.4. I'll be giving you some of the other frequencies as we go. If you want to listen to us over the internet, it's www.zfmstereo.co.zw. Download the TuneIn app, it's available for free, and you can listen to us live and in charge. The conversation is live on Twitter at ZFM Stereo, and our WhatsApp number is 0731 168 045. So Zimbabwe dropped three places and is now ranked 160 out of 180 in the Corruption Perception Index, which is brought to you by the Transparency International. While it retains a score of 22, which has been the same for the past 3 years, this will be a cause for worry because fighting corruption is one of the key pillars of the Second Republic, and President Mnangagwa has stated that his administration's goal is to build a new Zimbabwe based on transparency, accountability, and hard work. So in the studio today, I've got two representatives from Transparency International. First of all, Tashinga Zamba is the program officer. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Good evening, listeners.
And then got Alice Nyamazana, who is the Monitoring and Evaluation and Learning Officer at Transparency International. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Good evening, listeners.
Okay, first of all, for starters, what do you attribute, the continual downward trend, in spite of the fact that the points haven't changed in terms of dropping 3 points down, yet there has been a change in government?
Yeah, it's really a cause of concern. Since the coming into office of President Mnangagwa in November 2017, the talk has been zero tolerance to corruption. Understandably so. Corruption impacts negatively on the cost of doing business, hence very detrimental to the economy and Zimbabwe's open for business mantra. Various policy and institutional framework designed to curb corruption were introduced, such as the creation of the Special Anti-Corruption Courts, number one. Number two, the anti-corruption unit within the ZROP, as a declaration by senior public officials, to mention but a few. TIZ attributes this stagnant position to a deep structural failure in the framing of the anti-corruption agenda in Zimbabwe. This encompasses, number one, a lack of strong, effective, accountable institutions. There is need to have parliament with strong capacity for oversight, efficient judiciaries that are about the rule of law, which will ultimately lead to demise of corruption, impunity, etc. A vibrant and actively engaged civil society is also very important, and free independent media. Number two, there is also a lack of multi-stakeholder approach to fighting corruption that is geared towards preventing versus managing corruption. We have been managing corruption, not really preventing corruption.
So make me understand what managing corruption is.
Like being reactionary. Okay. We respond to issues that would have happened at that time, not creating sustainable institutions that would then prevent the corruption from happening. We are leaving the gaps open for corruption to thrive. Then we then respond to them. You see? So if we run away from a responsive attitude to a preventative attitude, then we will then create responsible and sustainable institutions. So going forward, number three, there's also lack of access to information regarding fiscal transparency. You understand? There's no information in the public domain how the money is being used. You know,
this will then reduce. When we talk about money, we're just talking money in the public in general.
Public money, which is coming maybe from taxpayers. Mm-hmm. Because people have got a keen interest of knowing what and how their money is being used. So having that fiscal transparency will then reduce corruption vulnerability in the management of public funds and increase in the livelihood that those who do so will be held accountable. However, Zimbabwe ranks very poorly in this area. In 2017 Open Budget Survey, OBS, Zimbabwe scored 23 out of 100, signifying that the government of Zimbabwe continues to provide the public with minimal budget information. Year in and year out, the Auditor General releases a report, but nothing is done. A report is coming out every year, but action is not happening to act on the recommendations of the Auditor General.
So when I think about the access to information, so there'll be a report that comes out.
Yes, and it's every year, Auditor General. Yeah.
But is there an understanding by the taxpayer of what that report is? Because sometimes the document may be legally available, it ticks the boxes, we've got an Auditor General's report, but the average member of the public sitting at home or wherever they are right now just simply doesn't understand it.
Because there's no information to say. Report of the Auditor General is public information. It's a public statement. Whoever is in the public is the consumer of that word, is the consumer of that statement. So we are at liberty to critique. We are also at liberty to ask questions. Why this money disappeared and nothing happened? Why this institution is continuing year in and year out, having reports coming from it, having embezzled funds, having misplaced the property, etc. Not being investigated, also not being investigated, I say. So that alone, information is very important and is key. Understand?
Okay, 0731-168-045. Do get in touch with us. Let's have this discussion. What do you think is the issues? For me, the lack of information is a huge one. I was looking at a report that just came out today. We said 1.3 billion people actually have very little understanding of the justice system, so they don't have access to full justice because they don't understand what their rights are. So I guess we could even put some Zimbabweans in that, in terms of the 1.3 billion. They just don't understand the Auditor General's report, so they just don't know what to ask.
Yeah, there's no balance. I mean, we need to know whether Zimbabwe operates as an open system or a closed system. This is why some people are then left behind because of lack of information. Are we supposed to know what happens in the budget? Are we supposed to know what also happens in the courts? Is that open? Are we supposed to know how we should go about when acquiring a passport, for example? Is it open or is closed? We need to be clear on that. If it's closed now, it will then leave gaps. It then allows those cracks for corruption to thrive. Because corruption thrives on fertilizer. That is a red tape, that is failure to provide clear information, that is also lack of political will. Those are very, very fertile grounds for corruption to thrive. So information is very key. Louis, you can
add. Yeah, maybe just to add on, I think the other reason why we keep on in the same position is lack of a monitoring and evaluation framework in terms of the way we are fighting corruption. Possibly we could be using approaches that doesn't work in our context. And in Zimbabwe, I don't remember reading or hearing about any monitoring and evaluation framework that is used by those who are supposed to fight corruption. So in the end, we keep on doing things, but without knowing whether we're achieving what we're supposed to achieve or not. So I think there's need for then a monitoring and evaluation, a results-based management system, where we are saying we are doing this and we've achieved this.
So is this the same way, for example, I took note of this in Rwanda, President Kagame's strict enforcement of compliance with the leadership code, that's what he does. Jorge Fonseca is an open promotion of institutional transparency in Cabo Verde, as well as then President Ian Khama in Botswana, innovative approach, what he called a mainstreaming anti-corruption across ministries in Botswana. And these countries learned what works best in their communities and pursue those tactics with commitment. Is that what you're talking about? Because sometimes we might just decide, okay, we want to use what's being used in Sweden, but not really looking at how it works in our own communities.
Yes, I think the most important thing is to do a thorough context analysis. We need to understand our context, what works in Zimbabwe, looking at our culture, looking at our background and our history. So that's the most important thing, because like what you're saying, Botswana, I think their anti-corruption initiatives, as I was reading and studying about it, is also rooted in their culture. So that's what you need to do as a country, to say, let's do a thorough contextual analysis, what works and what doesn't work. And even as we'll be implementing those initiatives, we need to sit down and reflect, and stop a bit to say, okay, we have done this, what have you achieved?
So this would then also, like Lou always is saying, and yourself is saying, it would then boil down to an anti-corruption strategy. You need to have a strategy, a roadmap of how you are going to go about fighting corruption in each different democracy. I can give an example. Is anti-corruption strategy or a national anti-corruption strategy is something that was prescribed by the United Nations Convention Against Corruption, Article 5 and 6. It says each and every member state who is a signatory to that convention should have a national strategy to fight corruption. No, so now in that strategy, you then find how you can track your progress in terms of what? Fighting corruption. And it, how you can also see where we are coming from and where we are going.
And also avoid duplication,
duplication of efforts.
You know, we might have 10 organizations that are fighting corruption, but doing the same thing.
Which means other sections might just be open.
Yes, yes.
We have the anti-corruption unit in the president's office. We have ISAC, right? We have an anti-corruption unit in the police, PGHQ headquarters. Mm. Are they not duplicating duties, if I may ask?
That'd be a fair thing to say.
What are their terms of reference?
Yeah.
Are they not the same? So if we have a strategy, we know now what this can be now be investigated by the unit in the press office at that level. Mm-hmm. And this type of corruption can also be investigated by ISAC at this certain level. And this one also can be investigated by police at this level. You understand? So having that anti-corruption strategy, as we are a signatory to that international article or international convention, we need to have that in Zimbabwe.
Yeah. So one of the organizations you've mentioned, ZAC, has been disbanded. And could this be a sign of change and efficiency from the organization tasked with fighting graft? And would this be an opportunity, for example, that you're talking about for separation of duties so that they can cover more?
In terms of change, let me say only time will tell. But what is crucial now is the new commissioners will be, how the new commissioners will be appointed. That's the most crucial part. There has to be transparency in terms of appointing the new commissioners that are of unquestionable integrity. That's the most important thing. Then, you know, I think for the most important thing is not about disbanding ZAC, but about how it functions. For example, for administrative purposes, you know, ZAC used to fall under the office of the president and cabinet. Perhaps in order to give it more teeth, it is prudent that they report directly to parliament for the sake of maybe creating that, strengthening that independence. Because, you know, for an institution to be independent, it has to be free from any political interference. So instead of reporting to the OPC, we feel as Transparency International, it has to report directly to parliament. So that's what you are looking at. And besides the issue of disbanding ZAC, we also feel that there's also need to create very strong institutions. For example, we have the NPA, we have the police, we have other regulated bodies that are responsible for fighting corruption. As long as those institutions are weak, even if they select good commissioners, whatever, the very efficient commissioners, they might not be able to deal with this corruption issue because of the other existing weak institutions.
Yeah, so there is also, to add on, most importantly, I don't know how they are going to be appointed, but first of all, we need to gauge people who've got, like Alois has said, integrity. There's personal integrity. There's institutional.
When it was disbanded, it was said the chair would be appointed by the president, but the rest will be chosen through parliamentary processes.
Yes, I mean, across the world, someone has to be appointed by someone.
So I'm saying that. So is it sufficient that the parliamentary processes are going to pick the commissioners for ZAC, or do you also feel that parliament itself is not necessarily equipped to do it?
Yes, I think looking at the Zimbabwean context, for example, like what Shatashinga mentioned earlier on, to say we have the Auditor General report. It should be the obligation of Parliament to ensure that those recommendations are implemented. But you see, the issue about the report is just discussed a few days after it's published. But right now, they are quiet about it. So we feel Parliament also should take an active part in terms of fighting corruption. So in terms of institutional framework, institutional strength, Parliament is not doing well. It has to do more than what it is doing right now. So, you know, regardless of having whatever, the new commissioners, whatever, but we also need strong institutional support.
Well, 731-168-0452, get in touch with us. I've got two messages here from K's the Don on Twitter, our Twitter handle being at ZFM Stereo, talking about corruption. Is that it's a bug that has been installed in us as Zimbabweans and has resulted in erosion of our Ubuntu culture. For it to end, it should start with parents educating their young ones on how bad it is and its consequences. The other reason why it's rampant in Zimbabwe and Africa as a whole is because we want to make quick money and aren't patient enough as a people.
Absolutely. He has nailed it to the point. We did a study in 2017, corruption and culture. Mm-hmm. And we found out that corruption has become part of our culture. If you see each and every dialect that is present in Zimbabwe, it has a name that it gives to corruption. For example, in Mutare, say Kudiza, Musana. It is trying to sanitize the name. It's trying to put the name to match whatever activities that we do every day.
Actually, it's just been normalized.
It's now very normal.
You know, even those people whom we expect to be very ethical, the church people, religious people, mm-hmm. sometimes they even condone corruption. And they say, you know, it's a way of life. How do you want me to survive?
To survive.
So people have actually internalized the corruption in our country.
Yeah, of course, there are many causes that can result people in bribing or something. One of which, cost of compliance. For example, in the borders, Simra, a bale of clothes, duty it pays $150, right? Then you are coming with five bales from Mozambique. A person can then choose to do other means, which are cheaper than $150. After all, how much do you want to sell the bale? So I'm saying, in as much as corruption has become our culture, institutions must also reform. We need to see how best we can then meet in terms of compliance.
Yeah, because the most important thing, Larry, is for the people to have confidence mm-hmm. in institutions so that they can report freely. I think there's nothing as painful as reporting and you expect to get some action, but in the process, nothing's done. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the most important thing is to build public confidence in our institutions. So that when a person comes, even also the issues around whistleblower protection policy, if a person reports corruption, what happens?
Okay, there's a big one that I want to talk about in its entirety. We're going to take a quick break. 0731-168-0445. That's our WhatsApp number. It's open right now. Let's have the conversation. What do you think needs to be done to deal with corruption? Is ZFM Stereo, my station, your station, the hottest radio in town.
Made in Zimbabwe, reaching out to the world. We've gone global. I'm going out tonight, feeling good now you're out of my life, don't want to talk about us. See, we are a global radio station.
News, lifestyle, charts, live radio, station highlights, and much more. Get it all on zfmstereo.co.zw.
The platform. Step up and speak up.
You're still tuned into ZFM Stereo, my station, your station, the hottest radio in town. We are talking corruption here on the platform. And in the studio, I've got from Transparency International two guests here, Tashinga Zamba, who is the program's officer, and Alois Nyamazana, who is the monitoring and evaluation and learning officer at the same organization. Now, I wanted to just touch on that a little bit later, in as far as I know you're talking, you're quite keen to get on to the whistleblowing aspect. I want to talk about more when we talk about the reforms that need to take place. I want to just get some of the things out of the way. When I look at it, there are issues also around convictions. In as far as cases go, I think you alluded to it where I think Alois, where you said they'll be reporting but nothing's been done. How does that affect public confidence in when you look at on current corruption conviction rates?
Yeah, let me start by saying the creation or the installment of the anti-corruption courts is a very noble idea. But the rate of convictions remains very, very low and minimal. The failure to hold to account those implicated in corruption scandals then creates an incentive for corruption and is also a threat to the rule of law and democracy. We have so much corruption. Corruption is just an elephant in the room. Everybody knows it, right? People have got perceptions of who is very corrupt and who is not corrupt. People are being arrested, but the rate of convictions is very low. You can't tell me that before the anti-corruption courts, you've got less than 10 corruption cases that are before it. I mean, how does that happen?
And I think to add on to what Tashinga is saying, if there are very few prosecution or sentencing of corrupt officials, the challenge that then happens is, instead of corrupt people becoming villains, they end up being regarded as heroes because they are doing some things that are not allowed, but at the end of the day, they are walking scot-free. So, you know, people, instead of fighting corruption, they end up seeing it as if it's rewarding, you know, because somebody's getting rich, somebody's getting wealthy, but through corrupt means, but nothing's being done to that person. So people then say, no, for me to then get some wealth, I need also to take part in these corrupt activities. So that's where the challenge is.
If a person who is alleged to have misplaced, for example, 5 million or 3 million or 300,000, what would then stop a person from Copacabana to just take $5 yes. for a bribe?
Yes, even it. What to call that Makumbe duty for yes. passport? I mean, the passport office to say other people are taking millions of dollars. Why can't I just take $5?
This segues into what Nyash has just said on 0731 168 045. It's a corruption. I pay it just because people are reporting, it's because people don't have enough income. Look at VID, our Tory license without bribing, and we can't do anything about it.
Yeah, we also need a mindset shift. Because from the start, when a person is applying for a learner's license, you come from home with the mind that I'm going to fail and I have to see somebody or to know somebody for me to pass. Same applies with the passports. If a person thinks of a passport in Budiriro, he will just say, do you know anyone there? Why? What if just going with an open mind to say, I'm going to get my form and apply?
I actually was having this conversation, incidentally enough, yesterday. There's a person I met just around from South Africa, is a Zimbabwean, and he says to me, oh, I need to go and get my passport because I'm only here for 4 days. And then he says, do you know anyone at the passport office? Like, you can just go there.
Oh, why should you know anyone? Well, I mean, why should you
know someone's auntie? Just went there, didn't know anyone, just walked, got into the queue, and I got sorted.
Yes, you can get it.
So that perception, the mindset, also becomes an issue, doesn't it?
You need to shift, mindset shift.
But, I mean, given that sort of scenario, I know before I've got this question for a little bit later, but how, beyond, because some of this public, the level corruption, for example, could be taking place in isolated spaces. So, for example, the district office somewhere or just a post office somewhere, where maybe there isn't as much connection to and information and as far as what is alleged at a bigger scale. Mm-hmm. What would be the way of changing the mindset in such smaller circumstances where it's still public funds that are at stake?
Yeah, as Chair is that we have got programs that we are doing, public education, especially on social accountability, to go around the country and teach people about corruption, teach people about holding public officers accountable. There is a draw, this is a council there. Mm-hmm. Empower people, capacitate them to say, these are servants of the people because they are in the public offices. So you've got the right to know whatever which is happening in them. For example, budget. Some people don't know that it's their mandate or their right to know how much money was allocated to this at a local council. You have to know. And you also have to have a scorecard to say, okay, 500,000 was allocated to roads, but we still have potholes in this road, this is council. Why? Where is the money going? Can we have a breakdown? that is public information. You are allowed to do so. So as Transparency International Zimbabwe, through the community engagement department, we are having such lessons. Even in Harare, people must actively participate in issues that affect them directly or indirectly. We have got the right to control, we've got the right to influence decision making at council level. To ask that councillor, which we voted into power, who promised us I'm going to reform this and this and this, why is it not happening when the budget was allocated? What are you saying to the meetings? Why are you not being accountable? Why are you not then coming back with the feedback? You see? So people must also have that azusa and energy to participate.
So, given that sort of scenario, I know we've noticed that, you know, the courts of law, the police, tax agencies, immigration departments were among institutions perceived to be the most corrupt when it came to the CPI report. Does it change now? And what sort of changes would need to? Because these are, in some instances, a lot of these organizations work together, which means there's opportunity for, I know I'm a cop, not this is, I mean, I know the cops are often seen as the low-hanging fruit. I'm going to use immigration for a change. I'm an immigration person, and I know someone from a different part of the tax department. I can make sure this goes through for you quickly. Or, you know, I know someone at the courts and so forth. I can make sure this doesn't happen. How do you deal with something like that? And especially given that the fact that you can't, it's difficult to do a wholesale faces for such, a change of faces rather, for such large organizations.
Yeah, most fundamentally, we need strong institutions that are just beyond individuals. If we create strong institutions that are beyond individuals, we will then close all the gaps that will allow corruption to happen. I talked earlier about institutional integrity. You know, you might be very corrupt, but the office that you are holding should have principles laid down, which then guarantees its effectiveness and efficiency in fighting corruption. So having ZAG being disbanded and leaving Zimra and other institutions, we need strong institutions that are then beyond individual capacities, beyond personalities.
Yeah, maybe I can just add to say, once we make a mistake of focusing on an individual, what happens if that person dies?
So you need an office which is strong than an individual.
So the most important thing is to work with strong systems.
Yes.
We need systems that are able to fight corruption, not individuals. You know, for example, the red tape in most of our public institutions, you know, cumbersome processes in accessing services, all those are very good breeding grounds for corruption. So we need, for example, right now we're talking of the digital era. We are in the digital era. Why can't we use ICTs to ensure that we improve efficiency in terms of service delivery so that people won't have to go through those, you know, cumbersome processes to get some services? So, you know, even if we change names and such, even if we appoint people of very high, you know, integrity, but issues around systems and creating strong institutions remain very key.
Yes, because when an office entails that getting a license for a certain business is it 12 hours or is it 4 hours, even if you are corrupt to a certain level, 4 hours is 4 hours. Your office says, and it's written and all laid down, to get a municipal health letter needs 4 hours to process. That will be 4 hours, and it will come out in 4 hours. That is a system put in place.
So in other words, are you saying that there is opportunity for accelerated corruption? Somebody might decide in those 4 hours I create a system. Because why I say that is a policy could come out today, and the people who are sitting there say, how am I going to game this? So you could come up with a system that you put into place, but you've got people that are always going to say, how is it that I can get around this? And that is their only obsession.
No, but I think we are talking of strengthening systems as one way of fighting corruption. Mm-hmm. But there are also other issues that should be considered. For example, issues of prosecuting those who are found guilty of corruption. You know, so even if we are changing names, it's like, but those that are found guilty, of corruption should be prosecuted. And that obviously can also contribute to the fight against corruption, because people become aware that corruption is a crime and I can go to jail. You know, so it's a combination of factors, even the national anti-corruption strategies that we're referring to say we need a coordinated approach. You asked us earlier on to say, what about a person there at the Royal District Council? We need to a framework, a strategy to ensure that people have access to information in terms of what they are supposed to be entitled to, what they are supposed to get.
Also to add on, like what you are saying, people must be prosecuted. Look at how China reacts to corruption. If a person is convicted of corruption, what is the price that you pay in China? You'll be killed.
Yes, sentenced.
Right? You will be sentenced to what? To death. Now, if you have 3-4 people in China being sentenced to death, do you think there's a person who can afford to get a bribe at a roadblock in China, knowing that you'll be denied your access to your oxygen in the next minute? It won't happen. So if we could have people being sentenced and given their sentence and put to jail, this would then act as a deterrent measure for other people to then follow in those footsteps. But if there's no one who has gone to jail because of corruption now, I mean, seriously, we won't be getting anywhere.
Okay, so I guess conviction is a big one. So somebody says, though a corrupt must be punished so as to strengthen others. I'm not sure what that means, but I think it is. I think the idea is to deter others. Thank you very much for getting in touch with us, Dennis. And just looking at other here, talking about police need to be remunerated when talk about corruption, an income which is lucrative so that they have enough to sustain their needs. Malchaza Ada Transau in Mutare. But that said, you've got places where they are relatively normal economic environments that did not do well on that list in as far as police corruption. I mean, I think the Kenya, for example, didn't do great that well in some of those, in spite of the fact that they have an economy that is doing well. So it goes beyond remuneration, because I guess somebody will always want more.
Yes, was how enough is enough? What would be enough for a person, especially for people who have corruption in their culture? People need to shift. People need mindset renewal. They need sector reset to say no to corruption. Help government institutions. Because in institutions it's a system, but a system is made up of people. We are the people. We need to desist from bribing. We need also to desist from a culture of just trying to know somebody to get resources, to get access to a service. We just need to desist from that, whether you've got money or not.
So obviously we've seen trends from other countries. So for example, I was looking at the index from last year. Eritrea had an improvement overall from 20 to 24, which is a huge jump. And the year before, they had gone down to 18, and they've just jumped from 20 to 24. How are they doing it? Not just them, but also the best performing countries.
The score that you have
improving the score. Maybe I can
answer that. One country that I've seen doing very well in terms of fighting corruption is Botswana. Like what I mentioned earlier on, the issue of anti-corruption fighting is embedded within their culture, within their society, and within the leadership. What I've seen is there's that there's that willingness by the leaders to fight corruption, and obviously that translates to political way. Where we are saying those people that are found to be guilty of corruption are supposed to be dealt with heavily. And, they also have a very strong legal framework that ensures that those that are found guilty of corruption are prosecuted. Even Singapore is another country that is doing very well in terms of fighting corruption. And in Singapore, their anti-corruption board is actually powered even to facilitate prosecution. So I think it's about also the legal framework in terms of fighting corruption. So, I mean, those countries that are doing very well, legal framework, political will, even the culture, like what Tashinga was saying, even if you give a person,
$2 million,
as long as the culture is there, then it won't be easy to fight corruption.
Okay, we look at Singapore, for example, where they go as far as executions and things of that nature. Does it have to be that drastic?
In terms of fighting corruption, I think it needs to be revisited. We need to go nearer to that.
Yeah.
I mean, Singapore, if you read in history, when the economy was very down, people sacrificed their private properties, like rings, earrings, to help the government to recover. But it was because those people trusted the institutions of government, right? Will you do that in Zimbabwe? To say, look, guys, the economy is not performing. Anyone with anything, can you just donate to government so that we can pay civil servant? You will fear because the money will then end up in two people's pockets. You understand? So you need to build trust first. You need to build trust of local people, ordinary people, to trust the government, to trust the institutions.
So given that sort of scenario, it goes nicely to what I wanted to ask then, is to say the effect is actually even further because when you really think about it, it's not, you mentioned it in passing, in as far as affecting investment. In what way does corruption actually affect investment?
Corruption is a big animal. It's a big elephant. If you are an investor looking for where to invest, first thing, you look at the corruption levels. Second thing, you look at the opportunities that are in the country. Third thing, you look at the political stability of that country. Now, the CPI score is 22 for the past 3 years. That means Zimbabwe is not improving in fighting corruption. How are we going to attract investment when we are one of the most corrupt countries in the globe? How does a person come with the money to such an environment which is not even suitable for investment? So we are saying, for us to attract then investment, we need to do more in fighting corruption. We need to then strengthen our institutions, like Alois was saying. We need to show a serious move towards clamping down on corruption.
Yeah, maybe I can add on to what Tashinga is saying, to say, Larry, how do you feel, or how do you take it to say you want to invest in a country, and you read about stories where maybe the top officials are saying, before you do this, you have to give me so much. So you are going to a country where before you do even any business, you are assured of loss before even get even a cent from that business. So, you know, those are some of the dynamics that you are saying. As long as we are corrupt as a nation, we will not be able to attract investment, because people, they will then fear to come to say, I will run loss even before I do the business. You know, so those are the challenges.
Zimbabwe is open for business.
Yes.
But it's not yet open for a corrupt-free Zimbabwe.
Yeah, because look, for example, to get those inspectors to give you approval just to run a shop, you know, it's a cumbersome process.
Yes,
you know, health approval to operate some premises. You know, the processes are too. But in some countries that are also doing well, it takes just 48 hours for a person to register a company, to get his papers, and to start a business.
So essentially, it cuts the opportunity to getting involved in anything corrupt, essentially, because the systems are so quick.
Yeah.
Red tape is a very good breeding ground. If things takes, maybe, 3 weeks or 2 months to get a license, that means we are going not less than 10 offices to complete the process. And in each office, there are certain demands. There are certain corrupt individuals who would want to eat from your deal. So if it is 48 hours, that means it's a one-stop shop. So you reduce opportunities for corruption. So Zimbabwe must and should attack corruption heads on if we want to prosper. If we want to attract investment, we need to be very serious. We need to create a transparent institution, accountable people.
Actually, there's a study that was done by World Bank, where corruption was listed as one of the top five deterrents to investment.
Yeah.
You know, so you see, and in some countries, you know, like what we're talking about, registering and starting business, I think it's Madagascar, if I'm not mistaken, where you can do the common registration online without even talking to anyone, and you get your papers, you know. So those are the things that we are saying we need to do to ensure that investors come with confidence.
Like, if you call someone now, you want to open a grocery shop in downtown, It's like someone who's responsible. You want to ask for the procedure. The first word is sakatukujike. Is what I want to say. Sakatukujikechi. You understand? That means the chakatukujikechi is supposed to maybe to be government driven. Those are some of the leakages. Those are some of the leakages that we are talking about. If people were serious.
It reminds me of one at one point I was working in a certain community and I had to work with guys from the social welfare. You know, I was here in Harare and I called them and said, guys, I'm coming there. Before they said anything, even asking what we wanted to do, you know, but we're talking of social welfare people who are supposed to be helping the vulnerable people.
Okay, so I want to get back to reporting straight after this because you did mention it, whistleblowing. Did you blow the whistle? ZFM Stereo, my station, your station, the hottest radio in town.
The platform. Step up and speak up.
We're the final segment of the platform, but as I said, I'm with you until 9 p.m. Here on ZFM Stereo. And at half past the hour of 8 o'clock, I will have a different guest, an oncologist, to talk about cervical cancer. And it being World Cancer Day yesterday, I will be tackling that issue in as far as getting tested. So stay tuned to ZFM Stereo right until the top of the hour with me. But as in this section of the show, it is the platform, and I am talking to representatives from Transparency International, and it got me feeling a little bit depressed about the whole corruption issue. And I think it's quite the right feeling to feel, because we have to start dealing head on with the issue. And one of the key things is whistleblowing. And you did mention earlier on issues of whistleblower protection.
Yes.
Alois.
Yes. It's important for us to have a whistleblower policy. Because I think we need to incentivize reporting corruption rather than making something that is frightening. Because if a person reports corruption, he or she has to know about his or her safety. You know, how safe is it to report corruption? And, you know, there's that grand political corruption where the elite are involved. In most instances, you might find yourself maybe in danger if you report those people. So it's important for us then to have a whistleblower protection policy to say if a person reports corruption, his or her safety is assured. And if once we do that, I think people then come forth in terms of reporting, exposing, and rejecting corruption.
There should be more of protecting the source of information.
Precisely.
And also more of investigation. These are still allegations. A person has blown the horn, right? So institutions like ZAC would then come in and make an investigation. These are still allegations, my friend, but we are investigating you about 1, 2, 3 allegations. That would be good.
Yeah, because there are also issues of defamation of character, where if a person reports, you know, tomorrow you might see, you know, someone's coming to you to say you defamed my character publicly.
Yes.
So those are some of the issues that we are saying. Those guys that report should be protected. As long as we do not have a whistleblower protection policy, then we are bound to continue having corruption. And all those things then can then be made able by the National Anti-Corruption Strategy.
Yes.
As long as we don't have a framework, a guiding framework to guide us in terms of fighting corruption, you will see that it's going to be even difficult to develop even the whistleblower policy.
Okay, so when we talk about this, when we talk about the whistleblower protection policy as part of the National Anti-Corruption Strategy, the issue that many have is to say, okay, I could go and report, but I just don't have enough evidence. I know there's something that's happening there. What does that sort of person do? And also then, of course, you can add on to that the fact that the corruption is such a difficult thing to investigate, because it's two willing parties.
Yes.
And either party doesn't really want to get exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that person do?
Yeah, I mean, it's so difficult, like you said, but as Alois has said, the whistleblowers protection policy or act will then protect those people. Then having more of investigation, you see, to build the evidence. Institutions responsible must build that evidence. I've blown the horn. Go ahead, Makombe. So and so is making people to pay bribes to get a form or to get whatever. those institutions should then claim down with such fame and alacrity down there to investigate and get the truth to the bottom of the earth. Because corruption is multi-dimensional. It cuts across the board.
And there should be a way of investigating without exposing the reporter.
The source.
The source of the source. Information. That's the most important thing. But you know, I think in our context, the challenge now is to say, you are saying there's corruption at Makumbi. Bring the evidence. Who is supposed to bring the evidence? Are they? Don't we have channels for investigations? You know, all those things need to be discussed and agreed upon as a nation.
As a nation.
Because, you know, we are dealing with some people who might not even have the confidence to talk in front of the public. But they're saying that person is witnessing corruption, and they're saying, please come and testify, you know, all those things.
But, I mean, adding to that, the issue of the evidence aside, there is also some people who feel, like you said, it's a cultural thing. Maybe I'm the one who's making it up. I know there's something wrong. I don't understand it, but you know, ndirukunyara or something like that. Or what if I'm wrong and I'm getting this person into trouble and stuff like that? Those things come into play. So how do you help convince a whistleblower in as far as getting out of that culture? You know, accusing people of things that you're not sure they did. Is frowned upon.
I think the most important thing is like what you have been saying all along. Political will plays a very important role in these issues. Because, you know, people want assurance. And that assurance can only come from the duty bearers. And the duty bearers are those guys, those people who are in leadership positions. So when dealing, you need to instill that public confidence. And how do we do that? Public engagement. You need to engage the public to say, as a government, we are taking this direction. And that should be followed by operationalizing whatever we're talking about. So it's about walking the talk. We don't just talk. We are saying we want to fight corruption. We want to protect our sources, our whistleblowers. How do we do that? Possibly ensuring that those cases where people come and report and they are maybe protected, we publicize it to the public to say, this has come forward, this person has come forward, and we are protecting him. We are protecting her in the, you know, all those things. So it's about walking the talk in terms of action.
What I know for sure, like Alois is saying, people in Zimbabwe, they really want to report for corruption, but the protection is their fear. For example, like what you're saying, there is a certain kind of corruption which is called sextortion, sexual extortion. When you use sex as a form of what? Exchange for a service, right? How do you report that? A woman is been sexually extorted. Let us then sleep together so that you get a job. And that woman is married. These are now cultural things. How do you then report? How do you then inform your husband that I have slept with this so-and-so HR manager to get this job that I have? You know, those are some of the cultural things that we always then come back to say. Corruption, as it is very multidimensional and very, very broad, we need to have protection. We need a mindset that is renewed.
Okay, 0731-168-045. Mark from CBD says, I would like to know to what extent these corruption indices rely on the political opinion of their owners or financiers, dominant shareholders, that is World Bank and IMF. I would like to know Nigeria's ranking. I've just looked it up. It's on 144 out of 180. We're on 160, by the way. And their score is 27 out of 100. Also, studies have revealed that Africa loses substantially more from private sector corruption, especially in the extractive sector, that is mining, vis-a-vis transfer pricing, etc. Do your guests have proposals as how we can tackle this?
Maybe, Larry, before we say much, we talk much about this issue, I think the most important thing that our listeners should know is that the ranking in terms of the position where we are is not the most important thing. The most important thing is the score. Because ranking can be affected by so many things. For example, if there's a change of, country that are participating in our survey, maybe the country that are coming in, also the ranking can change. Maybe some countries might be on ties. For example, in this one, like Bangladesh, Central Republic, Uganda, three countries were ranked 149. So we have five other countries ranked 152. you know. So that's affect the ranking in terms of which number are we at. But the most important thing now is the score.
But the question is, I guess the question that is there is, in terms of indices, I think they're referring to ranking, but I think what they really should talk about is score. To say Nigeria's got 27 out of 100, but yet this is a perception index. So I think the important thing to ask, though, I think for clarity, is how is this number, who comes up with this number, where's the perception created from? Is it created from externally, internally, where is it created?
Okay, I think it's a combination of factor, and just like any other research, you know, methodology, it might have its own limitations, but it's also, because we're talking about perceptions, so it's perceptions of the business people, perceptions of the broader community. It's not generated externally, but it's coming from the Zimbabweans. So it's a lot of combination. For example, maybe media monitoring, also talking to investors, talking to people, and a lot of other things, but it's not generated externally. Only that it compiled at TI headquarters, but the information is gathered from Zimbabwe.
But then there's the argument among many people that, especially if you look at social media, Zimbabweans have a tendency to say, okay, this is bad, but then they want to talk about it as if it's in worse circumstances than it is. Since the perception index, could 22 be not correct? Of course, you're talking about the limitations, but given that we tend to have this attitude, not to say this is 100% true all the time, those limitations, don't they, might they not have an impression on the score itself?
Yes, that's very true. You are like what I said, let me repeat. Like any other research method, it is your own limitations. That's why even research, you talk about confidence levels and all those things.
Margin
of error and all those things. Mm-hmm. But these scores, to be honest with you, they give us an indication, a picture of how we are performing. And if you had to ask anyone, even to throw a stone in town and ask a person to say, do we have corruption in Zimbabwe? People would just say, true, we have corruption.
Or have you ever paid a bribe?
Have you ever paid a bribe? People said we have bribe.
In your life.
No. I think we're at the same pace. I'm just trying to fully get the question answered.
Yeah.
Because, for example, when I was in Zambia the other time, I asked for direction from somebody, and they asked to be paid to just tell me where I should go and turn.
Where
and
the city is.
So the question is, I mean, I haven't experienced it this, and for all intents and purposes, it could have been an isolated case where when I went there, and then you go to certain countries that are ranked a little bit higher. The immigration, you're supposed to have an extra page where you're supposed to put money in for payments. You know, to get through if you want your stuff processed very quickly. They call it they'll say there's a page missing.
Okay.
So that perception aspect, where some countries will downplay the level of their corruption because for whatever reasons that culture has, and others will, you know, to say their corruption is worse than somebody else's, because of that's how it is.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think Tashinga also agrees.
Yeah.
Because issues around power dynamics cannot be ruled out, but overall, what you are then saying is they give us a picture. But like what I'm saying,
I think you say that, and I think you've answered it sufficiently. Before we go, I think we want to strengthen those points about what we need to do in as far as dealing with corruption. We mentioned the issues right at the beginning and what we need to deal with. I think there were 5 points. Do you want to go through them again quickly?
What we need to do to keep corruption. Number one, we need to build strong institutions guided by the National Anti-Corruption Strategy, which also makes provisions for whistleblower policy. Number two, we need to have a citizenry that is engaged in the fight against corruption. Freedom of expression is key in this regard. In some countries such as South Africa, social media has played a very big role in exposing corruption and keeping the public discourse around corruption alive. Improved access to information, especially in fiscal transparency, like I've mentioned before. Fiscal transparency would then reduce corruption vulnerabilities in the management of public funds and increase the likelihood that those who do so would be accountable. Improved ease of doing business, to speak high cost of compliance. you know. So we need to embrace some of these points. We need to embrace this culture of an open governance system so that each and every person understands what this office is supposed to do and what it's not supposed to do. And the channels that are followed when you have a complaint, the complaint mechanism.
You want to
read? I think the other important thing is also to look at the global framework of fighting corruption. For example, Zimbabwe is a member of the UNICAC, right?
UNICAC, yeah.
Yeah, we ratified UNICAC. Mm. And it's also important for us to ensure that we comply with the provisions of UNICAC. Because UNICAC lays, it is legal provisions that should then help us to speed up the process of fighting corruption. So it's important for us as a country to also learn from other established institutions like the World Bank, IMF, even other global organizations to see how then we can fight corruption. So it's important to embrace the global framework of fighting corruption.
Do you know that UNCAG also prescribes for the declaration of assets by public officials?
Mm.
We did sign that in Zimbabwe. We ratified it. Article 5 and 6. It calls for every public officer to declare assets before getting into office. But are we doing that?
We did say we can do it.
But also, there's still room to do that.
Yeah.
There's still room for reform.
Yeah.
Mm. We are still going to fight. We are still fighting. We are in the fight.
Yeah,
they still.
Well, I have to be optimistic that we are going to get it done. There's no other way to feel about these things because the other option is just not tenable.
Yeah, and the most important thing, Larry, before we go is there should be that what can I say, confidence within the public, and there should be that also that mutual agreement sort of between the public and those the duty bearers. Right now, as we speak, we are using a fragmented approach, whereby the government is going this way and the public is going this way. And we seem not to reach a common consensus and common ground with this, that lack of shared vision in terms of the way we are doing our things. So I think going ahead, we need to agree, what is our problem? What are our priorities? How do we get where we want to go? Both between the government and the public. That's the most important thing.
And do away with this confrontational relationship.
Yeah.
When you go to a public budget consultation, your idea is just to shout people, you are stealing money. No, let's sit down and say, you guys, how much do we have as council? We have this one. So what can we put to what?
And what costs what?
Yes.
Then you start understanding. Tashika Zamba, Programs Officer for Transparency International with Alois Nyamazana, who is the Monitoring and Evaluation and Learning Officer for the same organization. Thank you, gents, for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, listeners.
Right, we're taking a quick break right now. Coming back with Health Matters, and we are talking about cervical cancer. It was World Cancer Day just yesterday, but we're going to take a quick musical break here on